Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them.
Disrespect introduces David Shabib, a witness and videographer to David Johnson's campaign to sleep in the parks of Victoria without hindrance. Welcome to the show. Well, you have a lot of unusual angles on this case, if you will. We covered it with Catherine Boyce Parker when a lot more people were involved in camping in Cridge Park a few years ago. And now you've taken this case to court yourself, and David is bearing the brunt of the punishment for it in jail. And you told me several things about David that make jail a little harder time for him than most people would expect.
Yeah.
For instance,
he fasts. When he goes to jail, he refuses to eat.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to spend his life in jail.
And yeah.
And so he put a time limit on the amount of time that they could keep him by saying that I will either die in jail or you will give me justice.
Okay.
And I refuse to live with a system that won't allow me the freedom to do what I know to be conscientiously my right to do.
Okay. He's been fasting how long?
Off and on for over 7 years. He's been arrested over 40 times.
Really?
Yeah. And then there's a complete list of the amount of times that he's been arrested on the web and in a journal that he's been keeping called the Journal of the Occupation of St. Anne's Academy.
Give us the address.
Just that. Journal of the Occupation of St. Anne's Academy, and you will find it.
Okay, good.
He's been religiously keeping a diary of every arrest and his thoughts and discussions with the public that he's had over that period of time.
Right.
I'm going to be putting it out into a little book shortly, and then people will be able to get a hard copy of it.
Where will they be able to get a hard copy?
Oh, I'll put it on the web. It'll be at the bottom of the journal where they can get one.
Okay.
Right now he's in jail. He just got a 35-day sentence, which was consecutive with a 45-day sentence that he got previous to this one. And he got out off on the 45-day sentence, but waited 5 days, then reoffended, and went back in for 35 days.
Right, consecutive meaning that they normally follow one another, but in his case, that would have been a death sentence.
Yeah, that's right. And this second sentence is less than the first sentence for the same offense.
Really?
Because they're aware. Yes, it was 35 days, and the first one was 45 days.
What was the 45 and 35 for?
For sleeping at City Hall, he set up a camp at City Hall protesting the bylaw, which said the city had the right to determine when it was bedtime for the public.
Okay. Yeah. I'm sure the city views it as their inalienable right, Chair.
Yeah, but what's interesting about this case is that David went to court to have a judge tell him that he had the right to sleep and that the city could not interfere with his right to sleep. And the courts did rule that. It's called the Adams decision.
Okay.
And it was considered an injustice to deprive somebody of life-sustaining protection.
Okay.
And the city didn't like that. And so they took the law and they spun the law. And so they wrote another law. And they says, okay, the courts have ruled that it's illegal to prevent somebody from protecting themselves overnight with overnight shelter. So we're saying in the daytime, you cannot protect yourself.
Right.
You have to take down your shelter at 7 o'clock in the morning, and you can't put it up until 7 p.m. at night.
Right.
And so David, in protest of that bylaw, which both him and I believe is in contempt of the Supreme Court decision, reoffended. Both him and I got arrested at City Hall for setting up a camp and taking it back to court. We went back to court in February of 2009, and we were both found guilty by, a lesser court,
right,
of breaking this bylaw. And we were given a fine. We appealed the conviction, and we lost on the appeal.
All right.
So now we're at the third stage, where we have to go to the B.C. Court of Appeal and appeal the decision of the two lower courts.
Oh, okay. What happened to your lawyer in the meantime? She very capably represented you up to the Supreme Court last time, but yet did you figure you don't need a lawyer until you get to the Supreme Court?
No, I don't know why they're not on this. Well, they figured there was a win on the first one.
Yeah.
Everybody felt that was a win except for David and myself.
Okay.
We realized that a half a law is no law at all.
Right.
And that we kept going. And it's a long struggle with the courts. You're in court a long time. It takes a lot of energy. And I guess they just wore out after 5 years of being in court. And they were happy with the victory, which they thought they got.
Right.
And David, no, I'm not going to settle for this. This is not right. And he decided to continue, and I decided that he was right, and I continue with him as well.
Okay. I gather the lawyer's empathetic, though, because she passed my number on to David's mother, and David's mother passed it along to you.
What's happening with the city is the city keeps trying to deal with the homeless problem, mm-hmm, by writing new laws. They never try any other remedies.
Right.
And David has presented to them a solution, and with tenting zones, and say, look, hey, let's have a managed area where these people are given an option and are being looked after in a reasonable way, instead of just writing a law that tells people they can't stay here and there's nowhere else that they can go. The government is able to impose only those limits that it is able to demonstrate are justified in a free and democratic society.
Okay.
So what they're doing is they're saying that a few people, like the homeless,
yeah,
who are carrying out life-sustaining acts in parks, i.e. sleeping,
yeah,
have to balance those with the people who use the parks during the daytime. And the balance is saying you cannot sleep in the daytime in a park. You can only sleep there at night. Therefore, when the people walk in the park, they are not having to look at homeless people having a shelter and sleeping in the same space. So what they're doing is they're taking the segment of the society and they're saying that you do not have rights during the day. And they've done this by using the Section 1 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which say that they can justify taking away your rights to protect yourselves under a Section 1, which is, I believe, like a War Measures Act.
What is Section 1? How does it read?
It reads, the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms guarantees the rights and freedoms set out in it, subject only to such reasonable limits,
okay,
prescribed by law as can be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society.
So, let me translate as best I can. We're not going to see you done violence at night because you have to sleep without protection, but we don't want you to expand your life beyond what's required not to have violence done to you. We all want Lexuses and dogs to walk and chateaus in the suburbs, but for you, asking for more than to be able to sleep at night is unseemly. Is that about right?
Yes, and they've stretched it, too. Like, they've determined, the city's lawyer, when I asked him to define night, he said that we define when night is. And so at one point...
Really? God, yeah. Galileo would have choked on that one.
And so at this point, they said it's from 7 to 7.
Right.
And so I don't know if it's the same where you are as where I am.
You're further north.
But it's dark at like 4:30
yep.
now, and it doesn't get light until sometimes after 8.
Yeah.
So they are in contravention of the law as it is set out. And so the whole city of Victoria is in contempt of the court and is having a battle with the courts.
Yeah.
The judge said that the weakness of our position was our failure to compromise.
In what regard? Compromise over nighttime camping?
It says compromise over life essential requirements is basically the quote that they give. I can give it to you directly.
Sure.
Actually, placing limits on those life essential life-sustaining acts homeless people necessarily carry out in public and which are found to be fundamental rights under the Charter. David is putting his life on the line to defend the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and he's saying, you can kill me, but you can't force me to go against my conscience.
I see. Yeah.
And now he's in jail, and he will continue to stand and as best he can, as long as he can, and we will continue to take this case back to the courts until we get a judge who has the guts to tell the city of Victoria that it has to obey the law, and they can't tell people that they can't protect themselves.
How old is David now?
He's 37.
And you're not a young man, I understand.
No. Well, I am in my thoughts. I'm 67.
Okay. No, I understand. From the sound of my voice, because I'm animated and I love what I do, people expect that I'm much, much younger, too.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to paint the picture here of a couple of grown men fighting a city's, I don't know what the word for it, truculence, I would say, but it goes beyond that.
Well, I'd call it city tyranny.
City tyranny.
And we're winning. Like, they're wrong. They can't stand up to us in an open dialogue and justify what they're doing.
Yeah.
They're only able to do it behind closed doors and using police.
Yeah.
To enforce laws which are wrong.
How are the police about all this?
Well, what's happening is that in Victoria, that they have the homeless because they have nowhere to go. They have a huge homeless population here because we have good weather and a lot of people naturally come here.
Yeah.
And they have very few shelter beds.
Right.
And so a lot of people are forced to sleep outside. And then so they sleep in alleyways, they sleep in doorways.
And Victoria sounds like they're taking advantage of this. I mean, they're not building the shelter beds, right? They're saying, well, what's wrong with sleeping outside? You know?
Well, David doesn't want to sleep in the shelter.
Right.
He's not asking them. He's saying, no, you know, we're in a free and democratic society. I should be able to live according to my principles.
Mm-hmm.
And my principles are just, and I'm a conscientious user of what's available. And he was sleeping in the parks prior to this case getting started 7 years ago, and they were arresting him. They were coming around, kicking him while he was sleeping. And
kicking him? The police were kicking him?
There's, in the journal, the Provincial Capital Commission hired a security firm to actually keep him awake at night so he could not sleep.
Really?
And they would come along and do things like clap their hands and, Mr. Johnston, it's time to get up. You can't be sleeping here.
Your tax dollars at work.
And it was a huge amount of energy they used to try and prevent one guy just from sleeping peacefully.
I see.
And that was before we got a win in the Supreme Court when the judge said, yes, it was considered unjust to deny anybody the rights to protect themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Frightening.
Well, it's an adventure of life.
Yeah.
You know, we're in a time now where more and more people are becoming homeless, and they're going to have to deal with the problem and not just write laws and put people in jail because they've got nowhere to go.
Let's take a break. With Lacey Gibson, Wish Me Well.
well, baby, I'll be on my way. Wish me well, baby, I'll be on my way. We had a bad understanding this morning, couldn't get along anyway. Wish me well, I'll be back one day. Get along anyway. All right, so.
Isn't it Harper who across the country is building more jails to deal with this?
Well, they're getting more and more crowded, too. Like, now they're putting, you know, multiple people in one cell.
Yeah.
They don't have the space, and it costs like $85,000 a year to keep a person in jail. And they've proven that to keep a person homeless is far more expensive than it is to actually give them the opportunity to live in, like, smaller dwellings, like where they've got zoning, which prohibits more than four people from occupying the same place.
What do you mean? If you have three kids, you have to build two homes?
Well, it's more than four unrelated people.
Unrelated, okay.
But like my last house, I had five bedrooms in, and I was only allowed to have four people in that house, unrelated people.
So you and three others.
That's it.
Wow.
And so, like, in Victoria, they had, like, at one point, 25,000 illegal suites.
Yeah.
So, like, they pass laws to regulate the number of people that you can have in a specific space.
Right.
And so when you look at it, you realize how much real estate is controlling accommodations.
Okay.
And we don't really have, like, a homeless problem. We have a home problem.
Okay.
We have a problem with the mentality who is making the rules, restricting access. It's not legal to sleep in a car. You can't sleep in a camper within the city limits.
Really? Wow.
And if you're forced out, and like I know people who work during the day and have to sleep at, they work during the night and have to sleep during the day, and it's illegal for them to sleep during the day.
Yeah.
And in the last court case, it was proven, that there were 30 shelter beds in all of Victoria during the day, and the judge called that sufficient for a homeless population that's over 1,000 people.
I see.
So it's pretty ridiculous.
Where does it go from here? David gets out of jail. What does he do? Does he reoffend? Does he go home and recoup and recover?
Well,
where does the court case go? And where does David go?
Well, you keep appealing, and you keep appealing until you get to a judge, who, until you get to a level where there's some competency in the judgment, and they have to deal with you in law. And so where law has been set, like in this case, law has been set, and we have lower courts who are actually contradicting the law.
Yep.
And so we have to then go back to court, and we have to keep going to higher and higher courts until at some point we will reach the federal court in and have it as established as federal law.
Mm, okay.
So we keep going up the ladder.
But what happens to David in the meantime?
Well, I'm not too sure. At this point, at one point he got a 7-month sentence and for sleeping outside. They gave him 7 months in jail. And because he goes to jail, and when he goes to jail, he doesn't eat. It was a definite death sentence. And that's when the two lawyers that we have now made a charter appeal on David's behalf and on the other homeless people here's behalf, and got him out after 36 days.
Oh, okay.
And so...
So the 7 months is history now.
It's history.
But they hold this kind of threat over him.
Well, they keep saying it's either do what we tell you or we're going to put you back in jail. But now they know that they don't want him to die in jail. The police have tremendous respect for him.
Good.
The police, the last time they arrested him, did not handcuff him, which I've never seen.
Right.
And when one cop says, should we handcuff him, the guy says, no, David's peaceful.
Oh.
His protests are always peaceful. He's not a violent character. He lives like a monk, and he's taken a vow of poverty.
Okay.
Basically, he does not use money, and he's got a right to live the way he conscientiously believes he should.
Yeah.
And people are supposed to support people like that.
Yeah.
Because they are forerunners, and they are vanguards for us.
Right.
And we go to war to protect our freedom, and yet sometimes we miss what's going on right where we are.
That's true. So we don't know what happens to David from here on in, except he really doesn't have to fear the police. What he has to fear is the institution to which he must return if he's to succeed, and that's the courts.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And that's where we have to, you know, we're studying the law, both him and I. We put a good case together, mm-hmm. and the courts at this point are not giving us justice. They're not looking at our case within law and giving us a due course.
Now, forgive me, I'm ignorant. Do you need a lawyer to appear in Supreme Court, or no?
No.
You don't?
You always have the right to defend yourself.
Okay.
Before lawyers became so predominant, they only used lawyers for people who could not defend themselves.
Okay.
And anybody who had ability always stood up for themselves.
So
but the judges do not like to deal with people who are not represented by lawyers because they sometimes have to inform them of their rights, which they don't like to do.
Okay. But we are two steps away from that. We're B.C. Court of Appeal and then Supreme Court, aren't we?
Yes.
Okay.
Supreme Court of Canada.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but it's a struggle. Like, I think now it's the public that's got to be made aware of what's going on. Mm-hmm. And we have more and more people are becoming homeless. We're having an economic downturn, and the affluence that we've known before is disappearing. And so more and more people are becoming homeless. And they say for every homeless people, there are 26 more on the verge of homelessness. And so if you're looking at this case and you think, well, you know, what happens if I end up all of a sudden I've got nothing, where do I go? And you look at it, and shelters have limits on the amount of time that you can spend there. Like
I know, like a month maybe.
Yeah, and then you have to, and they don't have enough. Like here they only have, when we were in court, they had 266 shelter beds, and there was over like 1,200 homeless people.
Yeah.
And that's only the ones that the mayor's task force established as being homeless. Like I'm sure there's a lot more couch surfing and,
right.
you know, just crashing wherever they could and not, being visible weren't counted.
So
they got a problem, and they got to deal with they got to come up with a solution, and David has provided them with an alternative to that by saying, yes, let's have tenting areas where people don't have to fear being arrested, and they don't have to fear exposure from the elements. And they could do that, and they could have the loving support of the community. It doesn't have to become a crack alley reality.
Yeah.
It could be done with competency, and the public could feel welcome and not feel threatened by it.
How could we support this initiative?
I would say just become aware of the case. That's like what's happened in Victoria in the last arrest. But this case has been going on for 7 years, and the media here has almost done like a blackout on continuing to give report to it. So, I
really?
Guess what,
so you have a very right-wing
one
media.
Story. Well, what happened here, there was violence at one point against the mayor's house. He had a window smashed and some graffiti. And David was in jail and doing like a Gandhian-type fast and a peaceful, nonviolent demonstration, and he was not getting any coverage. But when some yahoos decided that, you know, these rules are going too far, then they did an attack on the mayor's house. And then every paper in town broadcast all this violent action, but not one of them mentioned that David was doing his peaceful protest.
Yeah.
And so they were all saying, oh, we don't support violence.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, they're giving all the attention to violence.
Okay.
And David is a very beautiful guy. He's very wise. He's very smart. He's a poet. He's a monk and he's a teacher. And he's brilliant.
Yeah.
And so he's been keeping a journal all the time, and it's a fantastic read. And we have quite a bit of video footage of arrests and of
any of it on the web.
Oh yes, oh yes.
Same place.
If you look at Love and Fearlessness, there's www.loveandfearlessness.
Right.
There's an hour and 40-minute documentary.
Okay.
That we've done of the struggle. This was prior to the Adams decision, which established the right in law for people to sleep outside at night and have protection.
All right. So what people can do is, A, inform themselves. B, how can you intervene at the BC Court of Appeal level? Can you file as an amicus curiae, an interested person affected by the decision, or...?
Well, this is an interesting case in many ways. The city's lawyer, Troy D'Souza, when we had the original trial and we were found guilty, the judge said there was no evidence that there was no daytime shelter beds available.
Right.
And so we filed an appeal, and we're granted a new trial based on that fact that we would submit evidence on daytime shelters, the availability of daytime shelter.
Has that taken place?
Pardon?
That trial taking place?
No, what happened was Troy D'Souza, the city's lawyer, went to court and said that they would submit by affidavit an agreement that there was no contention on that fact, that there were no daytime shelter beds available.
All right.
And had the trial changed back to a conventional trial from a new trial, so we didn't have to present that evidence.
Okay.
Then this trial judge said he had no evidence of the daytime shelter availability, therefore we didn't prove that we had a case for a protection under Section 7 of the Charter.
So you went through the same thing again?
The same thing again, which is ludicrous.
Yeah.
Because the evidence was all in the original case with the number of homeless people and the amount of shelter beds.
Yeah.
And this judge and the lawyer... like played a mind game, and agreed to do something, and then backed out of it, and then used that as on our part saying we didn't provide evidence.
Okay.
So now I'm trying to have the trial dismissed and have a new trial, and bring it back to the provincial Supreme Court.
All right.
And so that we don't have to go to the BC Court of Appeal and do like what the lawyers say now. Is that once you're convicted, it's much harder to overturn a conviction than it is to get a conviction in the first place.
So you're trying to undo this decision.
That's right.
As opposed to appeal it.
Yeah. And so that's where I'm at now. And David, I cannot connect with David because he's in jail.
Yeah.
I can't even visit with him because the last time he was in jail, I was holding the sign protesting his arrest, and I was arrested for holding a sign without a permit.
Oh, okay.
In Victoria. It was called holding an event without a permit.
I see. And so at least you made the status of an event.
So they put me in jail for that.
All right.
So it's no longer within, you cannot no longer demonstrate. If you're opposed to something here, we have no way to peacefully demonstrate our opposition because you can be arrested for holding a sign.
Hmm. Sounds like about 1937 Germany to me. Okay.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It does smack of a bit of fascism, for sure.
Yeah, okay.
And like I say, I would love to see some of these guys come on the line and like we can have conversations right now. We don't need to do it all behind. Like, why wait more years in the courts for there to make a decision? Why not have the judge and the politicians come on the line and make their case?
Yeah. Well, is there anything else that you would like to say about this before we close the interview?
Well, it's all perfect. It's what has to happen, and be patient, and you know, act with integrity, and in the end, you will win.
And the sites are love and www. Is it loveandfearlessness.com? Whatever.
Yes, loveandfearlessness.com.
.com. Okay, and the other site, the
Journal of the Occupation of St. Anne's Academy.
Appreciate that, David.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, St. Anne's Academy is interesting as well, because it was the first church in British Columbia, 1858.
Okay.
And now it's run by the Ministry of Education.
Hmm.
They bought it from the Sisters of St. Anne's.
Okay.
And so it's not a church. It is actually a provincial government establishment.
Okay.
And that's where this whole drama is taking place, in Victoria.
All right. Well, we'll keep our ear to the ground, and you have my email address. It's dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Please send me emails and keep me up to date on what's happening, and we can do an interview again when there's progress or not.
Good. Well, I hope it works out for you. It sounds...
Oh, I hope it works out. I hope it works out for you. The ultimate price for David is far too high to pay to win this case.
Well, you know, people went to war a lot. A lot of people died so we could have freedom today.
Yeah.
Let's not let it go too easily.
Okay.
All right, thanks, Jeff.
Thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, okay, bye.
Bye-bye. It's time now for a review of the week's news. These are not the articles we read to you. They appear in the newspapers that we read the titles of, and the authors in the broadcast. First up, website accessibility ruling to be appealed. Ottawa is appealing a court ruling that ordered the government to make its websites accessible to visually impaired users. Federal Court Justice Michael Kellen ruled in late November that the government had 15 months to update its websites. His ruling came on a constitutional challenge launched by Donna Hoden of Toronto, who said she was unable to apply for a public service job online. Government lawyers had argued there was no discrimination because all the services were available in other formats. That from the Toronto Star. Tax man to hit Canadian workers harder in 2011. The Canadian Taxpayers Federation released its annual tax calculations and projected an average increase of 2% in 2011 over 2010. The Federation said Ontario residents will see the sharpest payroll tax hike, with British Columbia and Nova Scotia right behind them. The Federation's report said the working poor, regardless of region, will be seriously affected. This year, everyone loses, although some more than others, said Derek Fildebrand, the Federation's National Research Director. In the Federation's research scenarios, Ontario residents saw an average increase of 4.3%. BC and Nova Scotia workers came in at 2.9%. Mr. Fildebrand said much of the blame for the increase lies with the Employment Insurance and Canada Pension Plan programs. The Federation, a nonprofit group that advocates for lower taxes, pointed to a program that provides $246 million in EI funds as special benefits for fisheries. Chisholm Potier, a Department of Finance spokesman, defended Prime Minister Stephen Harper's record on EI and added the Conservative government has kept EI premiums low with rate freezes. That by Sonny Dillon in the Globe and Mail.
Second G20 case reopened by SIU. Photos published in The Star prompt new questions. Ontario's police watchdog has reopened a second investigation into alleged police brutality during the G20 summit following the emergence of new photos. The Special Investigations Unit announced it will be taking a second look into injuries sustained by Dorian Barton, who alleges police assaulted him at Queen's Park, breaking his right arm and giving him a black eye. As a result, he filed a $250,000 lawsuit against seven Toronto police officers and the police board. The Star published new photos of Barton's arrest. That same day, Barton's father emailed those photos to the SIU. On January 12, 2011, the SIU received a number of photographs depicting officers in interaction with Mr. Barton during the demonstrations. As a result of this materially new information, Director Scott has reopened the investigation, said a press release. The SIU is also requesting the public's help in identifying a male wearing a green shirt and backpack in one of the photos, which were taken by Andrew Wallace. SIU spokesman Frank Phillips said investigators were interested in speaking with the man. Wallace took photos of Barton's takedown and told The Star that during Barton's arrest, he witnessed an officer slamming the young man's right side with a riot shield and hitting him with a baton as he lay on the ground. He watched as other officers dragged Barton across the pavement by his injured arm, Wallace said. The face of one of the officers in Wallace's photos is visible behind a visor. He is wearing a name tag, although the letters are too blurry to make out, and a Toronto Police Public Safety Unit badge. That officer has yet to be identified, according to Phillips. Barton was eventually brought to the Eastern Avenue Detention Center. 5 or 6 hours passed before he saw a medic, Barton said. He went to hospital under police guard and handcuffed to a bed. Doctors told him his arm was broken. He was charged with obstructing a police officer in unlawful demonstration. Barton spent 30 hours in custody. His charges were dropped on August 23rd. Only one criminal charge has been laid against an officer in relation to the violence during the G20 6 months ago. The SIU originally concluded in the case of Adam Nobody, it could not identify officers involved in alleged wrongdoing. Citizens then provided The Star and investigators with images that led to the agency reopening the case and charging an officer with a single count of assault with a weapon. That in the Toronto Star, James Poisson, staff reporter. This ain't Canada, G20 cop tells protester. A G20 incident caught on video shows several activists standing outside of the G20 security perimeter at King Street West and University Avenue on June 27th, while their bags are searched by a group of police officers. The mood is pleasant until a young man in a black t-shirt and cap refuses to hand over his backpack. Just outside the St. Andrew subway station, a male York Regional Police officer wraps an arm around the protester and tells him, "You don't get a choice. Get moving." "Why are you grabbing me, man?" says the unidentified protester. "I didn't do anything." The officer's badge number, 815, is clearly visible in the video. The officer with that number, Sergeant Mark Charlebois, said in an email that he would love to speak, but couldn't because the matter was before the Ontario Independent Police Review Director. The protester insists that as a Canadian, he has the right to refuse the search. But the officer disagrees. "This ain't Canada right now," he said. While the crowd laughs in disbelief, the officer continued to tell the protester he had two choices, leave or open his bag. The protester continues to refuse to do either. "I just don't like to have my civil rights violated," he says eventually. "There is no civil rights here in this area," the officer replies. "How many times do you gotta be told that?" "I was upset that police officers could make those kind of statements in a democracy," says Derek Soberall, co-filmmaker of the film Toronto G20 Exposed, who reposted the video on his YouTube site. The video has been viewed more than 40,000 times. That by Nicole Beauté, staff reporter in The Star. Death by indifference. The government's failure to build a childcare system has again proved fatal. The story of a little girl's death in an unregulated Ontario childcare home is but one of too many such stories over the past 25 years. This tragedy is unambiguous evidence of the consequences of government failure to build a childcare system. But all this fails to tell the real story behind Diane Nyan's heartbreaking death and her parents' grief. The past three decades saw a number of well-reported stories about other deaths in unregulated childcare, most recently in 2010. A 1999 inquest jury looking into an infant's strangulation death at an unregulated home recommended that the Community and Social Services Ministry initiate a full review of the Day Nurseries Act to provide safe and affordable daycare for children in Ontario. Ontario governments have created many initiatives. New directions for childcare, childcare reform, and Best Start, to name a few. But for successive generations of children and families, these have not added up to much more than slogans and piecemeal solutions. The statement of a mother who lost her child in unregulated care in 1999 still holds today. 80% of children in this province are in unregulated daycare, but there's nothing to protect them. The Day Nurseries Act only protects the 20% of children whose parents can afford licensed daycare. Most Canadian mothers with young children have limited childcare choices. Mothers' labor force participation has been one of the most significant social shifts to occur in the past few decades, but the childcare situation has not changed fundamentally since the 1980s. What's missing is a childcare system with real options like those enjoyed by children and families in many other countries. There is much evidence that building a real childcare system is the right thing to do for children and families. Education, the economy, health and safety, prosperity, and a human right. The governments of Ontario and Canada have both signed the Convention on the Rights of the Child, committing to ensuring that children of working parents have the right to benefit from childcare services and facilities. Surely we should be doing no less for children like Diane Nyan and their families. That by Martha Friendly in the Toronto Star. Single people, the undeserving poor. The poverty reduction strategy put forward by the provincial government is focused on decreasing the poverty rate by 25% for children. On its website, we learn tackling poverty means providing better opportunities for low-income families. What if you're not living in what is defined as a family situation? What if you are one of the thousands of seniors living in poverty in Hamilton? The increases to the Ontario Child Benefit won't benefit you. Single moms are often seen to have made bad choices, so we can't really give them money. But we can give knapsacks or breakfast to their children. Approximately 5,000 current Ontario Works recipients are unattached individuals trying to live off less than $600 a month. Do the math and see how far that would get you. There are no fruits and vegetables in that monthly budget. No bus pass to get you to those potential job interviews. No money for dental hygiene so you can present yourself proudly if you're able to snag a job interview. No money to fully participate in community life with dignity. So what needs to happen this year in order to keep the momentum going on eliminating poverty in this community? Before the election, more than half of the current council said they saw poverty as a top issue for this year. Urge them to get down to what they promised. Let's make Hamilton the best place to raise everyone affected by poverty. Unattached individuals, seniors, Aboriginal people, visible minorities, women, and yes, children too. That in the Hamilton Spectator, Saturday, January 15th by Deirdre Pike. And now a break with Steel Rail, Midnight Road.
Tonight I could not sleep. Put on my coat and found the street. Cold to the bone, is too. So he sings me sad and blue. It's the only sound in this old town. I'm walking that midnight road. Midnight road, midnight road. I never felt so alone.
Character, not policy, is the issue. So what the symbolic box question Ontarians will be urged to answer when in October they have to choose a government for the following 4 years? The economy will be a central issue, but it will be difficult for the opposition to frame a clear question on this subject. People know the economic crisis wasn't generated in Ontario. Just like the rest of the industrialized world, we were forced to adopt and implement economic measures well outside of standard political ideology. Second point, the strong cooperation between the federal conservative government and the provincial liberals in Ontario has further blurred the ideological difference between liberals and conservatives. When they're speaking about the economy, the federal conservatives sound like the Ontario liberals, while the Ontario conservatives make the same criticisms as the federal liberals. Even the precarious harmonized sales tax debate might not be the decisive issue. After all, the reason the HST is now law in Ontario is because of the urging and cooperation of the federal conservatives. What about the other two major issues that have shaped the last three provincial elections, education and health care? Sure, the Liberals didn't solve all the problems, and the healthcare system is in dire need of structural change, but the Conservatives don't have the credibility to lead these changes, and certainly not to campaign on them. So if it's not about the economy, education, or Medicare, what will the next provincial election be about? Hudak is not a shoo-in. He can't count on Liberal fatigue to ensure his victory. For most Ontarians, he's still a pig in a poke, and voters are not necessarily willing to bet on something they don't know at a very difficult time, even if what they have is not perfect. For now, the only sure thing about the upcoming campaign is that it is not going to be about issues. It's going to be about trust and character. That by Angelo Persichilli in the Toronto Star. A story more difficult for me to read because there is a tangential personal connection and a death related to it. Globe reporter rewarded for public policy writing. The Globe's public health reporter, Andre Picard, will receive an award recognizing a career's worth of writing on public policy. The Hyman Solomon Award, presented annually by the Public Policy Forum, a Canadian think tank, is awarded to journalists who explain to Canadians how policy changes affect them. A Globe staffer since 1987, Mr. Picard recently has written on Canada's dementia crisis and the debate over the controversial liberation therapy treatment for MS patients. Mr. Picard will be presented with the award in Toronto on April 28th. That by Adrian Morrow in the Globe and Mail. Mr. Picard, along with reporters at The Star and The Post, were all alerted to a story on January 20th of a young child, Nathan Shuchuk, being cared for under doubtful circumstances in an Edmonton hospital. All three refused to respond to the lead on the 21st. Nolan Shuchuk died just a short while before 8:30, said the source. I believe he was murdered. He died soon after I got word they had started a morphine regimen and he was transferred off the ward he had been admitted to. It's possible that the intervention of a major national newspaper might have saved this child's life. On a lighter note, None So Blind as Those Who Cannot See Award from the Globe. To United Airlines flight attendants who forgot about a blind passenger, Jessica Cabot of Courtney, B.C., after her flight landed in Chicago. As the woman waited patiently to be assisted off the plane, she heard the door seal shut. Luckily, maintenance workers rescued her 10 minutes later. Offering an apology, United spokeswoman said Mrs. Cabot had been overlooked because she was a tiny girl. Does that mean, Miss Cabot asked, if you're short, they're not responsible? Again, that from the Globe and Mail. Editor in the Life section, Kevin Sue. And in the good news department. Thought we'd forgotten that this week, didn't you? TFC's newest player is used to a good fight. He's got MS. For 21-year-old right back Demetrius Omfroy, Toronto FC's first pick at Thursday's Major League Soccer Super Draft, the challenge of keeping pace with opposition wingers has fallen down the depth chart of his concerns as he struggled to come to terms with multiple sclerosis, a condition that first affected him when he was 17. But wasn't officially diagnosed until last year. I lost the vision in my eye from multiple sclerosis, Omfroy said, and now that I'm able to manage it, I'm kind of beating it myself. I am getting to pursue my dream. Despite being warned by doctors that he might go blind, Omfroy's vision gradually returned and the tingling in his foot subsided, and since being diagnosed, the native of Alameda, California, has had few problems coping. I have to take these injections once a day, and it's not into the muscle, it's into the skin. I've been symptom-free since I've been taking it. I've been changing my diet, eating organic food, and from that I've actually been able to play to my fullest ability. It's actually helped me become a more healthy person, just because I have to watch and be careful what I eat. That in the Globe and Mail, Paul Atfield in Toronto. And that's all the news we have for you this week on Disrespect. But come back next week, and there will be more. To take us out, Lucy Kaplansky. You're Still Standing There. Now I've been down a thousand trails, and everyone
keeps turning upside down, and you're still standing there.
If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.